Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the You Say Beta, I Say Beta edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. We are recording on Jordan Weissman's birthday. Happy birthday, Jordan.
Hello. Thank you, Felix.
We have really 2 weeks worth of news to cover here because, frankly, we covered no news whatsoever last week with Bianca Bosca and our sloppy wine episode. We're going back to basics here, but over the past couple of weeks, we had the official triggering of Article 50. Britain is going to leave the European Union in March of 2019, and I'm very sad about that. And we're not going to talk about that. We are going to talk about racial discrimination in car insurance, and we're going to talk about whether you can use like market mechanisms to set rents on the internet and websites, and we're going to talk about smart beta, which is one of these weird things which everyone thinks they know what it is, and whether it's eating active management. We're going to talk about all manner of stuff, but because we're not talking about Article 50, we are not going to talk about the fact that a company which is quite close to my heart and which we've talked about on the show in the past, Unilever, looks like it's going to finally get rid of its weird schizophrenic existence where it has its two different companies, one of which is English and one of which is Dutch, and they have two different boards of directors which coincidentally have exactly the same members on them. and it's just like one of the most bizarre and anachronistic corporate structures in the world. And with the exit of Britain from the EU, it's going to come to an end, and Unilever is going to have to make a decision about whether it is going to have its headquarters in London or whether it is going to have its headquarters in Rotterdam. And the answer is, it is going to have its headquarters in our favorite town, the Dutch port of Rotterdam.
Yes, and we also, conveniently,
because that's the segue, people. Yeah, that's how we
that was impressive.
Roll.
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say, well, I want to compliment Felix on pulling a Trump there, where you have a long discussion of something by saying you're not going to talk about it. However, aside from that, on the topic of Rotterdam, we got an email from a fan, so I just wanted to say happy birthday to Jess in Rotterdam.
Happy birthday, Jess.
Happy birthday, Jess.
And this is the birthday boy wishing you a happy birthday.
From one April birthday to another, your husband Eric sent us a note and said that you've been a super fan of the show and would love a shout out. So thank you so much for listening for how many hundred episodes
we've done. We're well into the triple digits now. So
yeah, we're old. world. Me, wait, Jess, everyone.
We first
show.
Of all, most importantly, we need to talk about who we are. There's me. There's Jordan. We know, like, I'm Felix Salmon Infusion. Jordan Weissman is from Slate. Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
Welcome back.
I am excited to be back.
It's extraordinarily exciting to have you back here. And for the listeners who missed the sort of rushed introduction to Anna Szymanski from last time around, I think maybe we should slow down and mention, like, just a little bit more about you.
Sure.
What brings you here?
Well, I've been enjoying unemployment for the past few weeks.
Way to sell yourself hard there.
Anna Szymanski is an unemployed podcaster.
Yes, I've worked in distressed debt private equity for a number of years, and recently left an EM distressed debt desk to...
EM stands for...
Emerging markets.
Which is
the best
places
of all possible
like
markets.
Chad and Venezuela.
Chad would probably more be a frontier.
Okay.
But yes, and so I'm very excited to see
so
that.
Anna's here, and we're going to be deep, and because she's an expert in all things asset management, she is going to tell me and Jordan and the rest of us what a smart beta is and whether you can
Wait,
eat it.
Okay, beta? I thought beta.
It's beta.
Beta. Okay, if you say beta, I'm okay.
It's definitely beta.
I have a little bit of English left in me. I say aluminium.
Article 50 hasn't taken all of it out.
I say aluminium and I say beta, so, you know, suck it. But first, I think I want to talk about Julia Angwin's story. Every time Julia Angwin publishes a piece on ProPublica about evil algorithms, there's some kind of weird Slate Money bylaw that we have to talk about it with Cathy O'Neill. Cathy O'Neill is not here, but somehow the bylaw is still in effect.
Yep.
So we need to talk about it anyway. And this month's grand Julia Angwin investigation cover is actually, I would say, the most compelling one yet. And if you haven't read it, you should. And it covers car insurance. And it covers the way in which mostly brown inner city neighborhoods pay vastly more for car insurance than mostly white suburbs. And there's no good reason for this. Specifically, what they managed to do, and this is absolute genius, is they managed to file a bunch of FOIA requests and find four different states where they could get detailed zip code by zip code data on how much it costs a car insurer to insure a car in each zip code, how much money they pay out per car owner, per insured each year. And so they could say, well, this zip code is exactly the same risk as that zip code. And invariably, if you found two zip codes which have exactly the same risk, where, say, you know, the car insurers pay out on average $210 per car per year, the insurance in the white zip code would be substantially less than the insurance in the black zip code. This comes as a great shocking surprise to the entire industry. And upon the publication of this article, the industry said, oh my God, you've discovered something horrific. We're going to change our ways. And thank you for pointing this out.
No. Decidedly not.
Decidedly not. So, Anna, what do you think is going on here, and why are they so weirdly defensive about it?
Well, I mean, again, this is a very heavily regulated industry. And part of the issue that the insurers are saying, and there's some validity to their claim that the model that ProPublica used has some faults. You're not comparing apples to apples. But the problem is, the reason that ProPublica can't compare apples to apples is because they can't access the data. The reason they can't access the data is because the insurers won't give them the data. And then the insurers say, well, your model's wrong, thus your conclusions are wrong, and we won't give you the data. So it's a bit of a vicious circle here where we see anecdotal data. We've seen a number
of...
Well,
this is more than just anecdotal.
Oh, of course. No, but I'm saying we see things on the ground. We've seen previous reports that seem to have suggested the same thing. And now we have the study. And again, there are problems with this study. There's no way you can't say that there aren't.
Well, what jumps out at you is a big problem with it, out of curiosity?
Well, one issue, if you actually dive into their model, the R-squared, to show how much premiums are affected by risk, it would suggest that there's no relationship between risk and premiums, which makes no sense. Because that's essentially how you price.
If you look at the chart, I mean, this is actually really interesting. They have a series of scatter charts in this piece. And there's no one who loves scatter charts more than me. I can stare at scatter charts for hours. And I was looking at these scatter charts, and they're very interesting. And what they do is they basically plot the risk of a neighborhood on one axis against the price of insurance on the other. And you're right. If you just eyeball these scatter charts, there's very little correlation there. And specifically, what you generally find is a huge number of neighborhoods who are in 100%, and this is the really shocking thing. If you look at the lowest price, the lowest car insurance price, there's a couple of notches where that's like the lowest amount the car insurers charge. And all of those neighborhoods are white, and they vary wildly in riskiness. The amount that the insurers pay out in those neighborhoods can go from very low to very high. But the one thing they all have in common is that they're white. All of the brown neighborhoods are more expensive, no matter how risky they are.
So one thing that might be throwing off the R squared is racism.
Exactly. You have a bunch of very high-risk white neighborhoods with very low premiums, and that's throwing off the R squared.
Right. But the problem here, two things. Also, you're comparing average loss costs of an entire zip code and then with an individual's premium. So you're not necessarily comparing apples to apples here. I think that's actually a big problem with the way this model is structured. And again, if you look at how low that R squared is, it almost suggests there's no correlation. And again, I don't argue that. I actually think they're probably very... There almost has to be something here, because even if there is a problem with the model, the fact that you're seeing this in almost every district suggests that there's something here. But
and the fact, as I say, that you see zero majority minority neighborhoods in those lowest tiers is indicative of something.
It calls out. Yes, certainly. And I think the issue that I ask is that, again, this is a very heavily regulated market. So that means that the regulators that are looking at the data, that have more access to the data, they aren't seeing a problem here.
And I would push back a little bit on that. Insurance is one of the weirdestly regulated markets. In virtually every other bit of financial services, the big regulators are federal. There's no federal insurance regulator, or at least none with any teeth. All of the insurance, all of the regulation, the real regulation of the insurance industry happens at the state level. And different states have wildly differing regulation regimes. And
California is much stronger.
But this investigation covered both California and Illinois, which are more or less at opposite ends of that spectrum. But the point is that because this is only done at the state level, I don't know any insurance regulators who have ever made much in the way of noise about what's known as disparate impact and the way that an algorithm can be like unwittingly racist.
And this is, I mean... this is kind of advanced stuff for your typical insurance regulator. They tend to be much more interested in like basic rate setting and things along those lines.
And solvency.
Lines.
What they really care about more than anything else is that if if someone has a claim, then the insurer has enough money to pay that claim.
Yeah.
That's their number one thing. These questions about racism and disparate impact are barely on their radar screen.
And it was interesting to see the extent to which the regulators themselves got very defensive when ProPublica approached
them. It's almost as though they're captured by the industry.
That was what struck me, because usually, if a regulator gets confronted with this, usually the response would be something like, well, here are the reasons why we think this is wrong, or, here's some things you might not have taken into account. But instead, they're like, this is trash. We're not going to talk about it.
But I think this is actually the problem with the ProPublica study, is that by putting out a study that has all these methodological flaws that any first, actuarial student who has barely passed one test can point out, it makes it very easy for the regulators and for the industry to say, these conclusions are useless. Well, But again, the problem is, again, they can't access the data to have a better study.
So what do we think is actually going on here? Because I have a theory, which is that there's this kind of muscle memory in the insurance industry from the 70s, basically, when you had white flight and the inner city blight and all of these things, and inner cities were genuinely very dangerous places and suburbs were much safer. And the way that the insurance industry wound up responding to that was by measuring this thing called congestion. This is the one vague thing which they point to in their statements about, like, well, this explains blah, 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 blah. Of course, it doesn't really explain anything. But it is generally understood in the car insurance industry that they penalize this thing called congestion, and that if you're in an inner city where there's more congestion, then your insurance rates are going to be higher. Even though, when you stop to think about it, there's no particular reason why a congested neighborhood should cost more to insure a car in.
No, I mean, you could potentially say there'd be more accidents, but no, I agree. In fact,
the opposite. I mean, I think of where, you know, my little country house, which is like a very sort of white neighborhood where everyone drives drunk and has expensive cars and gets in accidents all the time, versus my, you know, home in Chinatown in Manhattan, where barely anyone ever even drives. You're not going to get into an accident if you're not driving your car. Yeah. But if I were to insure my car in Chinatown, it would cost much more than if I insure it up in, you know, the middle of nowhere.
So, right. So congestion pricing is what you think is just kind of trail. So I think there's probably some of that. Again, I do think the bigger story here is, to some extent, the relationship between the regulators, though, and these companies. You know, it's partly the fact that the regulators aren't doing anything to make this less opaque, that they're, right. You know, they're not really creating confidence for consumers. But also, just like, if you stop and think about this whole setup, right, it kind of is ripe for victimization, right? You are required to buy car insurance, right? If you have a car, you have to own it. There is a mandate. And if these companies are being left to, you know, basically do rates that, you know, to penalize minorities based on congestion or whatever, like that's deeply, deeply predatory. And you kind of have to rethink, okay, what is the relationship here? Why aren't they doing their best to make sure this isn't the case? And why aren't they doing their best to make sure the public, you know, has a full understanding of how this actually works? Why isn't there a bias towards transparency?
No, and I think it's an important question. And I would imagine that part of this also just has to do with kind of the compounding impact of historical and institutional racism, that a lot of the tools that insurance companies and actuaries are going to use in terms of how they determine risk are going to be factors that are going to disproportionately negatively impact minorities. Things like your occupation, your level of education, there are just because of
your credit rating.
Your credit rating. And actually, that's the biggest issue. Credit scoring has really revolutionized how pricing is done in the auto insurance industry. And we all know that your kind of credit score has really issues in terms of how it impacts minorities. So I think that what's probably going on here is not necessarily that anyone's trying to be horribly racist, but just the tools that they are using are, in some sense, inherently racist because they factor in.
And no one really cares enough to do anything about it.
Exactly, because the people who are suffering here, and you're really suffering, because if you don't have access to car insurance, then if you're driving without auto insurance, you're more likely to get arrested. Also, then you can't get to your job. I mean, this is a serious issue because, as you said, it's a product you are forced to buy.
And so there's this idea that these companies should be allowed to, you know, keep their special sauce secret or whatever, that they should be allowed to have their algorithms non-public.
Disparate impact algorithms.
Yeah, exactly. And so long as there are rules in place saying that you have to buy this product, I think they're really like state regulators. I mean, this is all within the power of state regulators, state legislators to say, actually, no, you have to reveal your algorithm. We don't care if it's a quote trade secret. We get to decide what a trade secret is. That's all a matter of state law. So this seems like the kind of thing where this needs to, as long as people have to go and pay possibly $900 a year for this, you know, for this piece of paper saying you're insured, they have to at least be given the confidence that they're not being ripped off.
So if there are any state regulators out there listening to Slate Money,
just one
of you, just one.
One state insurance
maybe Hawaii, you know, just make it happen, people.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Jordan.
Yep.
How do you feel about the idea that there can be some kind of dynamic real-time pricing for apartment rentals?
Not that terrible. Like, okay, so we're going to talk about a startup called Rentberry.
Bad name.
Yeah, bad name. But Gizmodo, I think, referred to it recently as the startup of your nightmares. It's also gotten some attention from Christopher Mims at the Wall Street Journal. A bunch of places have been writing about it. And what does Rentberry do? Well, they allow, it's basically a combination of Craigslist and eBay. They allow landlords who are trying to rent an apartment to hold an auction. And you can bid, lots of people can bid on the apartment they are trying to rent. And they get, you know, right now, Rentberry gets a $25 cut per commission. Eventually, they have a business model that's a little bit more advanced. But yeah, the idea is that possibly the landlord could end up, they say the landlord could end up making more money if people overbid. Or their argument is that consumers could end up getting a slightly better deal if people underbid.
But how is that going to happen? If the landlord just has a price, and then people bid and no one bids the amount that the landlord wants, the landlord will just keep it on the market until someone pays that price,
right? this is a problem that's come up apparently with other companies that have tried to do this. They've discovered that auctions might not necessarily be the best model for renting apartments. There's a reason why, for instance, eBay has actually just kind of become a marketplace where people pay fixed prices for things rather than having as many auctions mm-hmm. as they used to. So it's not clear how wonderfully this particular business model is going to work out, but it does have a lot of people, including fair housing advocates, freaked out because, in part, the CEO of this company is a very
nice. Can we say tech bro?
The tech bro. But he's a guy named Alex Lubinsky, and he's very much a wannabe Travis Kalanick, where he kind of came out and immediately announced that, hey, I'm in San Francisco, and the startup I created raises rents by 5%. And so everyone freaked the hell out. Then later on, he's like, well, across the country, it actually lowers them by 5% because he realized not all good press. Well, not all press was good press.
But coming out and saying the rents are too damn low is a pretty ballsy thing to do.
Well, so this is my theory. We can discuss this for like startup marketing is that every young founder now thinks you either have to be a black hat or a white hat. You either have to be like a hero or a villain, but you can't be boring. You have to like to get attention and to like get into TechCrunch, you have to have like some sort of like moral valence to what you're doing.
Right. But to get actual funding, you have to not be a significant risk. And if you have a product that people really like or is actually different and could add value, you have more degrees of freedom. Whereas when you are essentially just offering a platform that anyone else can replicate and other startups, in fact, have replicated, you don't have quite the same freedom.
So, but let's talk about the idea, Anna. What do you make of the idea that it makes, just like if I'm selling my house, I'll get a bunch of bids and I'll try and get them to bid against each other. If I'm renting my apartment, shouldn't I be able to do the same thing?
Yeah, I actually don't think there's anything wrong with this. I think the idea that it's somehow going to turn us into this Hunger Games, Ayn Randian hellscape, we are already there. Anyone who has rented an apartment in New York City or San Francisco in the last 10 years knows that we are already there and there's no transparency. When you go to an open house and there are 15, 20, 30 other people, you have no idea what prices those other people are bringing in. So in theory, this type of model could be beneficial. And the most important thing is it could reduce broker fees, application fees, all of those middlemen fees that increase the cost of renting. And although this raises another question of whether it would actually ever be adopted, because a lot of those interests are going to want to keep taking those fees.
The key word, you said it for me, is broker, right? Like in New York, I think we're especially sensitive to this because New York has this bizarre rental market where you have rental brokers. It's like not a thing in most places. Most places you have like, you know, home sales. You have a realtor who brokers those. But here, if you want to rent, oftentimes you have to go through someone who's just going to take a cut to basically show you an apartment that you could have found on a website. So insofar as this, you know, in a place like New York can eliminate that middleman who's kind of just extracting rent, mm-hmm. as you might say, like that, it's a good thing. But also just more generally, the idea of kind of, you know, taking out middlemen from the entire real estate industry. You know, we've reached a point where it seems kind of strange that we even have, you know, brokers for home sales. Why are they still, you know, most of their job can be mechanized. And so even if maybe the idea of having, you know, even if auctions might not work so wonderfully in the rental market, I guess time will tell. We do know that basically every home sale is an auction. And so, you know, a platform like this could be fantastic for, you know, just the basics of buying and selling homes.
So explain to me then.
Yeah.
What is it about Rentberry that causes so many people to get so very upset?
So I do think that there's this idea that auctions tend to lead people to overpay for things.
And that is not buyer's just curse. An idea. Yeah. This is, Anna, what is the buyer's curse?
It's the idea that whoever wins an auction almost inherently has overpaid. That just by definite, by winning, you are almost always going to have
if
to
you have If you have 100 people bidding in an auction and they all have an idea of what something is worth, and like there's a couple of outliers in that group of 100 who are just completely wrong.
Yeah.
Then if you're an outlier who's wrong on the downside, it's a kind of no harm, no foul, and you don't win the auction. If you're an outlier who's wrong on the upside and you've just made a mistake about how much that apartment is worth, you wind up bidding way more than it's worth, and then you get it for way more than it's worth, and that's called the winner's curse.
Yes, the winner's curse, and it's like a classic, this is a classic problem in auctions, but it's more severe typically in situations where you're dealing with something that with an indeterminate value, like a piece of art, a painting is like a classic example, but mm-hmm. also even things like oil, mineral rights, where you kind of have to guess what it's worth. It's not clear how much oil is actually there. With something like this, where you're looking at it, where you can actually see basically the entire market for like what the rental market, you can see what the rental market looks like in part thanks to platforms like these. I think that might be a little less of a problem because it's less guessing like what something is worth.
Do you buy this? I don't buy this.
No. And I guess my concern also, I don't know the like logistics of how this platform works, because I guess the other concern would be, is there any limitation on how many apartments you can bid on? And how much you could bid up. If you bid, are you required then?
Oh, interesting.
Because I guess I wonder if like the Tinder problem of like you just bid on like like 50 different apartments with the idea of one of them, you know, and then it just creates, you're kind of bidding all of these prices up. I think that could potentially be a concern.
But then like, what do you do if you accidentally win them? And then
win all 50 of them. Exactly. Like, yeah. I don't know. That as a landlord, that would probably.
It's hard for the platform to contractually bind you to renting the apartment. So it winds up going to the underbidder, but you do wind up having, you know, what in the financial markets we'll call spoofing. You know, there's a whole bunch of fake bids, which are making things more expensive. And making it much harder to achieve what the ostensible goal of this platform is, which is transparent price discovery.
Do you think that you would have a similar issue if you were to extend a platform like this to just regular home buying? Possibly. It's hard to, because I'm really enthusiastic basically for this like other use case.
Right.
Well, I mean, we can have another segment of this podcast about the way that the property market in Australia, because that is all done with auctions and generally in-person auctions. And it all happens very, very quickly. And it's very different from the American experience where you can sit on the market for months and months and nothing happens. But that's buying. And this is renting, and we don't have time to talk about buying. So, Anna, I'm going to leave the final word to you. Rentbury, good idea or like doomed idea?
I think good idea, but I think Rentbury itself is doomed.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So one of the things we have talked many, many times about on this show, and one of the few times that we have been very unapologetic about giving investment advice, is to say, go ahead and buy index funds. Passive investment is a good thing, and paying someone to manage your money is generally not a good idea, because the chances that you can pick one of the few people who will outperform is very low. So we're not going to relitigate the whole active versus passive thing, because we've done it a million times. But Anna, there's an interesting twist here. It's not just pure passive management, which is competing with active management. There's also this thing called
Smart beta.
Okay.
Beta.
So what is smart beta?
So smart beta is actually a fairly simple idea. It's basically supposed to be melding the best of active and passive management. So you get the liquidity, the low cost, the tax advantages of an ETF, but in theory, you also get the diversification, the outperformance, the lower volatility of active management. Now, how does this work? So most ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, will track a market cap-weighted index like the S&P. And so these smart beta ETFs, instead, they track factor-weighted indices. Now, what is a factor-weighted indices? Okay, it's simply an index weighted based on certain characteristics of these stocks. Now, there are traditionally, you think of like value or growth. The most popular factors are either value, momentum, size, I think quality. So basically,
it's institutionalizing what a stock picker does.
So yes,
if a stock picker says, "I want to buy stocks which are going up," and this is actually something which pickers do. It's called momentum trading. It's a thing that exists. It actually does quite well. Then you actually don't need a human to do that. You can just program a computer to buy stocks which are going up.
So the premise behind these strategies was that they did studies and they saw that a lot of the alpha that was generated by the best stock pickers, people like Warren Buffett, was based not on the actual securities they picked, but on these factors that they favored. So then they said, well, if these humans can do it, computers can do it better, and they can do it much more cheaply. Okay, but this raises a lot of questions.
But let's just get to the news hook quickly. What's BlackRock doing?
So BlackRock announced last week that 11% of their actively managed portfolios, they were going to be shifting either into quant-based or these rules-based trading strategies.
Basically, they're moving from humans to computers in one way or another.
Yes.
And this is because computers are better and cheaper than humans.
Most likely. Although, again, a lot of the active quant funds have not necessarily performed super well either. That's a whole other issue.
Okay. So and BlackRock has, what, $2.5-3 trillion?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're pretty much the biggest asset manager in the world.
Yeah.
And so where they go is
the rest of the industry
can follow.
And
they are also – they bought the Barclays passive management portfolio. So they're also really, really huge in passive management. It's called iShares.
Yep.
So they are huge in active management. They are huge in passive management. And now they are taking that active management part of what they do and they're making it more robot-y.
Correct.
And I guess cheaper?
Yes. I mean, it's an ETF. So ETFs are going to be, by definition, significantly cheaper than a mutual fund or any type of traditional actively managed fund. But there, so this sounds great. I mean, this sounds fantastic. It sounds like you're getting active management strategies for an ETF price. Who doesn't love that?
Why would I? I mean, I wouldn't love that because I don't have any reason to believe that active management strategies are better. But as I say, we're not going to litigate that
right.
One.
But the idea is
Jordan,
that if you,
so how, as the naive investor, how am I going to get screwed? Because that's like the soul of all of this. How am I going to get the soul of investing is Jordan's going to get screwed. So how is that going to happen?
And you might not. So the company which has been doing this the longest is Dimensional. They heard that you can go back and they are very much in this field of passive factor-based investing. And they have been for decades. They are on the side of the angels when it comes to the active versus passive debate. And when Michael Lewis, for instance, decided that he wanted to write an article about active versus passive investing, he was the Dimensional were the people that he held up as like, these are the kind of people who are doing it right. So you can, and over time, it turns out if you look at how Dimensional has performed, they have performed well.
But you were, Anna, you were looking at me like there is some reason why Jordan's going to get screwed. So
well, a few things. So even though there are some of these products that have been around for a while, a lot of them are fairly new and they're being marketed not with actual performance, but with back-tested data, which is a issue. So basically,
I can hear Kathy O'Neill screaming.
As she should be. So essentially that you're not saying this is our actual historical 10-year performance. You're saying if we had been using this strategy over the past 10 years, it would have generated this performance. There are so many problems with that. When you are setting the parameters of how you define performance and when you start and when you stop, you can manipulate that data to pretty much...
It's unbelievably easy to make money in the past if you get to choose yes. in the present, like how you're picking the stocks.
Exactly. And the ability to then replicate that in the future is obviously quite hard. And then on top of that, it also is another separate issue, which is that simply part of the reason that active management often doesn't work is because of mean reversion. So just because something has outperformed for the past 10 years, not only does that not mean that it will outperform in the next 10 years, it also means it almost is less likely to outperform in the next 10 years.
So my question is a slightly different one, which is there going to be a significant move from active management into smart beta over and above what we are already seeing, which is a massive, significant move from active management into passive, insofar as smart beta is an alternative to pure passive investing? Is it going to wind up becoming a beneficiary of a generalized move out of active management because finally everyone has worked out that active management sucks?
Right. And right now, smart beta is still a fairly small percentage of the market, but it's growing significantly. And if you're talking to a lot of institutional investors, it's like 2/3 are saying they don't have these products, they are looking to invest in these products. And so it looks like this could be an alternative that a lot of investors will go to because they still want the potential to outperform the market. They still want the potential for more diversification, for lower volatility. And the problem with these strategies, just because essentially these strategies are arguing that there are anomalies, there are issues in the standard market that we are taking advantage of by weighting certain factors. The problem, we all know from efficient market hypothesis, is that if the market identifies an anomaly, it then goes in, corrects, and then eliminates that potential for outperformance. So,
well, it does in theory. In practice, there's this thing called the equity premium,
it's the equity risk premium. But you're only getting more return because you're taking on more risk. So if it's risk weighted, you're not actually getting higher.
So with the kind of, let's talk about secret sauce again, right? Because these ETFs, it's not like they're posting their formula.
They are.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Very simple.
How are they going to make money off this thing? It would seem like at the very least, it would all just get competed down to zero.
And that's precisely the problem.
Exactly what's happening.
You'll get crowding.
No, but that's not a problem. That's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, for consumers.
It's both.
If you have this not secret sauce, which is very public, and how I'm running my ETF, then people will choose that strategy with the lowest fees, and that's good for consumers because it will drive fees down. That's a good thing.
Except it's also potentially going to drive valuations of the underlying assets up, so then your potential to actually have capital appreciation, to actually have diversification, is going to come down.
Everyone is going to flee into these stocks or whatever.
And then you could also have the issue that people will start jumping between factors. Like, this factor is like the hot factor right now. Then you start to have some mean reversion. Oh, then you leave and you go into another. So then you would have been better just being in a simple passive product as opposed to this type of strategy, which the other issue is these factors are cyclical. So you have to hold this for a long time
people,
to see the benefit.
Yeah, the basic, what we're saying here, people, is don't do it.
This is like a restaurant that's awesome until people start going to it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
Yes.
Especially if you're thinking that you can do one kind of strategy for a few years and then switch to another kind of strategy, that's the old-fashioned, I know, I'm just going to buy low and sell high.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is, it works in theory.
In theory, yeah, exactly.
It works until it doesn't.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay. Let's have a numbers round.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
What's your number, Jordan?
My number is 0.00195%.
That's not a very big number.
No, it's a very tiny number. That is how much wages have gone up year over year adjusted for inflation. There's this interesting thing that for a while, U.S. wage growth was rising fairly slowly, but inflation was so low that families were getting, were getting raises every year. They were getting an increased standard of living. Now, slowly, that's changing. All of a sudden, inflation is eating up Americans' pay or pay hikes. And I don't know if this is a long-term thing or if it's just kind of like a little bump, but I think it's worth watching because it's not a good situation, especially if you get to the point where inflation's, rising faster than wages, because then obviously standards of living fall.
I have a congestion-related number going back to our insurance discussion, which is 3.5 million. We are very close now to the official opening of the shiny new donut-shaped Apple campus in Cupertino, California, which is one of the most expensive and redonkulous buildings that has been built in the history of the planet. And it's very big. It's over 3 million square feet of office space. 3.5 million is a slightly bigger number than the number of square feet of office space and is the number of square feet of parking that Apple is obliged to provide. It doesn't want to provide, but under state law, it has to provide for its office building. And so it has 3.5 million square feet of parking, both underneath the building and in a couple of structures next door, by law. And if you understand the 3.5 million square feet of parking and what that implies for whether or not people are going to drive to the campus and what that implies for the amount of traffic on the roads in the Southern Bay and all the rest of it, suddenly you understand virtually all of the problems with real estate in Northern California.
Yeah, I mean, like, couldn't they just relax the parking regulations? Like, couldn't they just say
they
don't
totally
have to,
could?
You One don't have think. To build that like, much. You don't have to, have people drive in on a goddamn bus, just like Google.
I can guarantee.
It's like the ghost of Robert Moses is somewhere here forcing these people to have so much parking.
I can guarantee you that that 3.5 million square feet of parking will never all be used, or maybe just once for like the WWDC conference. And if it wasn't there, then they would find some other way of getting the people where they needed to be on that day.
Yeah. So my number is 37%. And that is the amount that real estate prices increased in Zhangjiang County in China after the government announced that they were going to be making a new special economic zone around that county. And the reason that I think this is significant, I mean, there are a lot of stories about like, this is a obscure rural county and you have people like jumping onto the highways, camping outside of real estate offices to engage in speculation. But the really thing I think is interesting is in terms of how this could impact commodity prices and then in turn how that could impact EM economies and how just this one move by China could have such a dramatic
one
impact.
One new special economic zone? Okay, walk me through this.
Yeah.
First, how does it affect commodity prices?
So when you've had like Shenzhen or Pudong, I mean, again, these were in the past, but one of my favorite statistics about China is that between 2011 and 2013, they consumed more cement than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century. When China develops, it develops. So part of the reason that we've seen a fall off in a lot of commodity prices since 2014 is because China's been rebalancing their economy away from this type of heavy infrastructure investment. So this announcement suggests that the government is going to, at least to a certain extent, continue to support that. So prices of cement, prices of iron ore, prices of steel, prices of copper, all of these building materials, I mean, we've already seen a little bit of a move just since this announcement. And if this continues, because this is also part of this giant megalopolis, mispronouncing that word, that China is attempting to build of like 130 million people. And so this
10
this
million people, that's not cool. You know what's cool?
130 million people. So this is the type of announcement that could potentially actually alter the global economy. At the end of the day, like what happens in China is what actually matters.
Brilliant. So, okay. So if you want to understand iron prices, just look to special economic zones in China. I think that's it. I think that's all we have time for this week. All it leaves for me to do is to extend the world's biggest thanks to Anna Szymanski, who, honestly, it's just so wonderful having Anna here because she knows what she's talking about. And also to the various...
I just got nagged.
On your birthday, no less.
Also to extend a happy birthday to everyone, whether they are here in the studio, whether they're in the Netherlands or everywhere around the country who's having a birthday this week. Because it's a happy birthday. I'm feeling a happy birthday sort of feeling.
Thanks, Felix.
I have my own birthday coming up. And to thank Zach Dinerstein, June Thomas, Steve Lichtai, Andy Bowers, and the entire Panoply crew who can be found. All of their podcasts can be found at Panoply FM. Panoply.fm, I should say. So come check those out. Write to us. Please do continue to write to us at SlateMoney@Slate.com. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Girl in the special economic zone. Girl in the special economic zone. Clothes sign swinging in the window of the liquor store.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.